What's up, guys? Welcome to Winnipeg's Finest, the podcast where we get personal with notable Winnipeggers. If you haven't been with us before, here's what you've missed.
Like, I even feel like I've always known that I was supposed to be here, so it's like, even if there was stuff that I went through, I always went through it knowing that this isn't, like, the end of everything, you know what I mean? This isn't the end of the world. If there's anything, actually, that I would tell myself, is to not be so afraid of failure.
Oh, yeah. How different was it for you to watch a movie where Kevin Spacey is the villain?
I mean, I feel like they just told him to be himself.
It's like, dude, be a shitty person who's a predator and, like, does bad things. And
yeah.
Kevin Spacey's like, I got you.
Oh, boy, this is my role.
Hey, Mr. Professor, look at me, make money.
What? Call campus security.
Thank you so much to the fans who continue to support. You guys are awesome. We love you like crazy. This is why we love podcasting. This is why we love bringing you guys episodes. Please remember to subscribe on Apple Podcasts or Spotify or wherever you're listening. Remember to follow us on social media at WPGS Finest Pod on Instagram. And make sure you're staying posted and telling people about the podcast. We appreciate and love the support you give us. So just know that it lifts us up so much and we're very grateful.
What's up, guys? Welcome to a brand new episode of Winnipeg's Finest. Today's guest is Dean Jenkinson, local comedian, also in charge of the Winnipeg Comedy Festival, not the Winnipeg Comedy Showcase. I fucked that up in the episode. That's Jared's story. But no, today we talk a lot about comedy. We talk about the Winnipeg scene and how it's been built over the last couple decades. And so he's been in the game for a while. I appreciate his insight and his willingness to be on the show and talk to us. This is a wonderful episode. Comedy lovers, especially of local stand-up, you'll love this. So Edmonton listeners, Egypt listeners, I'm sorry, guys, you might not get this one as much, but I still love you nonetheless. Today's episode brought to you by Unity Underwear, the best underwear on the planet. It's made of 95% bamboo, 5% spandex. Yeah, it's made mostly of bamboo. Some of the most comfortable shit I've ever worn in my entire life. It's stretchy, perfect, everything you want in underwear. If you use our code WPGSFINEST, you get 20% off your purchases. And we're also brought to you by Jellyfish Flow Spot, the best place in Winnipeg to receive flow therapy, where you lie in an isolation tank full of 1,000 pounds of Epsom salt and water, and you just float, and you get to hang out, and you just get to chill, relax. It's an awesome time. If you use our code WPGSFINEST, you get 15% off all float purchases. Now, here's our episode with Dean Jenkinson.
And there we go. We're recording. And it's nice to actually, I was just going to say, we're not going to talk about my glasses. Here I am. It's nice to wear glasses on that podcast again. But here I am. Dean, how's it going, man?
I'm really good. How about you?
I'm pretty good. It's nice to sit down with you and chat about comedy. And I mean, it's not necessarily the greatest timing in the world to talk about comedy because there is none going on, but.
What do they say in sports? It's a rebuilding year for comedy.
Yeah. Comedy's on a sabbatical.
That's right. We're taking some time away to reflect on the success of comedy.
Yeah, you know what? I would totally be okay with doing rooms in which two people sat in each corner and one person stood in the middle, but maybe that's just because I'm a weirdo.
I think a lot of people feel the same way. I know, you know, the idea of doing shows for smaller spaced out groups immediately sounded terrible to everybody, but I think everybody who's done it is like, you know what, this isn't as bad as I feared, and in fact I'm so happy for it, because we're starving for crumbs, so when you get those crumbs it's like a feast, right? And you're parched and you're thirsty, and then you get some laughs, and you don't care if it's laughs from three people or 300 people, you'll take three people and it feels like 300.
Yeah, anything sounds like, you know, a packed house at Rumors when you haven't done comedy for months.
I always tell people, it's like, you know, as you know, if you try to put together a room for comedy, you want all the conditions that COVID won't allow. You want people tight together in a low ceiling where they lose their sense of individuality and they kind of have that, you just become part of that organic beast that is the audience, and you lose your self-consciousness, and that is part of what allows you to, you know, let go and laugh and lose your inhibitions. And when you separate people, people become more self-conscious, right? So it's trying to like, it's like trying to light a fire by spreading the wood out, and it's not going to work as well, right? If you gather the wood all together, you can get a big blaze, and with every little puff of wind you blow on it, you get a big flame. Mm-hmm. Same thing in comedy. So right now we're in peak terrible conditions for comedy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that sucks, right? I mean, like, we're big comedy guys, so it sucks for us to not be able to have it or perform or watch locally. You know, I love watching Netflix specials, but it just doesn't hit as much as actually going to the club.
Absolutely true.
Yeah, I know you guys did. I mean, the comedy festival was minimized this year. It wasn't canceled completely. There were still a couple shows, but
yeah,
how was that kind of planning for that?
We did some shows at the end of August, and you run that, you know, you're walking that wire of wanting to let people be aware of it and know about it and publicize it, but you don't want to stick your head too high up and make yourself too seen, because then you invite all the fault finders to say, well, are you doing it safely? And the answer is yes, we are. But are you doing it safely enough to satisfy me? Well, it depends if you're a reasonable person. But everybody who came out felt sufficiently protected. We had a room that seats 240. And the province says you're allowed to have it at 30% capacity, which would be, you know, roughly 70 people. And we said, well, let's sell 40 tickets. So we were at essentially, you know, 17 to 18% capacity. And I was shocked at just how empty it looks, but how full it felt and how big the laughs got. Like, it didn't feel like trying to light a fire with six pieces of wood spread around a beach, right? It actually felt like people were very happy to be there and a lot of big laughs. It was really kind of edifying. And now at the end of October, we're going to try to tape our Winnipeg Comedy Festival TV shows. So that's coming up in like 2.5 weeks.
Oh.
And we're going to do that sort of with a by invitation only crowd. We're not going to sell tickets because we don't, you know, two reasons. One, we don't think we're necessarily, you know, find a lot of people interested in paying big money to come to a distance television taping. And two, we want to sort of gift anybody who's interested in attending with a free show and sort of say thank you for coming and supporting this and being there to respond to the comics and make them, you know, able to produce a show that they can be proud of, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, easily, absolutely. And that venue that you did it at, 40, like 18% capacity, was that at the gas station?
Yeah, the Gas Station Arts Center, exactly.
Yeah, how was that?
It was really good, you know, and we, you know, did our homework, and we had the outside patio was open in the few hours before that, and we had some live music and some, you know, old TV galas that we'd show, so we could have people out and distanced on the patio in the fresh air prior to that, and you can sit and have a beer and then come into the theater with the other 30, 35 people and mm-hmm. watch the show for about 75 minutes. And then we kicked them out into the back alley, so they didn't even have to congregate in the cramped lobby, right? We just said, there you go. We put a light up so that you can see exactly who's asking for your wallet.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. I'm sure it's like, you know, with anything in life, you go too long without seeing your friend, or you go too long without going to the gym, or you go too long without seeing your partner or your spouse. When you finally see them, it might not be the greatest time ever by normal standards, but because you haven't seen them or been there forever, it's like, oh man, this is amazing.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think, you know, for most comics, it was sort of in that 90 to 100 days since they had last been on stage kind of thing when they first did their first show. So yeah, it's a little like riding a bike where, oh yeah, it comes back to you, but it's also like, man, I feel really rusty and I don't remember how this works, and I don't feel I got my legs underneath me, and I don't feel like I remember how timing works, and I don't feel like I remember any of it, right? But it comes back to you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and especially with the new restrictions placed, we're in what, phase orange or code orange or clockwork orange or whatever the heck it is now that... You can only have 10 people inside or whatever, and everybody's got to wear a mask. I think that's kind of essentially throwing one last blanket on the ember of laughter for now.
Yeah. I mean, I know all the new restrictions are personal restrictions. So, you know, Rumors Comedy Club is still up and operating. You have to wear a mask when you walk in the door. You have to wear a mask as you walk to your table. Once you're at the table, just like in a restaurant, you're allowed to take it off if you choose to, from what I understand. And then if you get up to go to the washroom or anything else, put your mask back on, right? But much like a restaurant, they can have their patrons still there. And similarly, all the restrictions for theaters are exactly what they were. That didn't change in the new rules. It's just, you know, hopefully if people are taking care of wearing masks when they're in public and people are taking care of limiting their private gatherings, that the province can, you know, I guess they're acting like, let's try to keep as many businesses open, keep the economy as open as we can, and keep as many people protected in those ways.
Yeah, I think even like, I know it's difficult now to kind of gauge comedy scenes and all that, but I do think even in the short years that I've been in it, the Winnipeg comedy scene has expanded so much. And I think it's actually great, right? A lot of people might roll their eyes at the mention of Winnipeg, the city, like, oh, Winnipeg. But the comedy scene here is awesome. And I really think there's a lot of talented people and the structure is great. What do you think?
Absolutely. I mean, I was doing, like I was telling you before we started recording, we were just chatting before we pressed play and record as we do in 2020, right? You push the two buttons together on the cassette recorder. Mm-hmm. I started doing amateur nights in like 1990 and 91. And there was Rumors, which is still here. There was a Yuck Yucks in Osborne Village, and there was a club on St. Mary's called the Comedy Oasis. So there were really only three rooms. They all brought in out-of-town headliners. But there weren't these rooms like Wee Johnny's and The Handsome Daughter and you know, the Winnipeg Comedy Showcase at the Park Theater and all these smaller rooms that individual producers are running. But having said that, Winnipeg is a great place to start, and it's a great place to get stage time and to suck while you suck, right? Because we all suck when we start. Nobody, right? Very few people get on stage, and from the moment they get on stage, they've got it figured out, right? We all crawl before we walk and walk before we run, and some people never quite figure out how to run, and they just stay walking for most of their, you know, comedy tenure. Mm-hmm. But Winnipeg's a great place to get stage time and to have really good audiences, because we have a lot of wonderful audiences and good comedy fans in Winnipeg who will support that kind of stuff. So it's a great place to get your feet under you and to learn how to do it, and then to make a leap to a bigger market, which you know, many people have done, except me.
Okay, we're back somehow. Technology sucks. I'm kidding. It doesn't. I'm just too cheap to pay for good Wi-Fi, apparently. That's what is wrong with me, I think. Let me get out of this view. This is not the view that we usually record in. There we go. No, not everybody has to see Cannon drink whatever the hell he's drinking as I'm talking.
Orange juice.
What?
Orange juice.
Whatever.
Why is that such a weird thing to drink?
It's not weird. You're just always eating or doing something. When we're
I'm fat. I gotta fill my. I gotta hit my calorie counts, bro. About to drink a Kool-Aid Jammer too. You got a problem with that?
No, I don't. I don't. The Kool-Aid Jammer, I don't have a problem with for some reason. But yeah, no, Winnipeg is a comedy scene. I think, you know, I know a lot of people talk about how it's changed over the years. How have you seen it change over the last decade or so?
Yeah, I don't even know if I could tell you about the last decade or so. I feel like, I mean, I know when I started back in the, you know, early 90s, I think 1990, I did my first open mic. And there was Rumors in Tuxedo, which is still there. There was a Yuck Yucks in Osborne Village that later moved to the Viscount Gort. There was a club on St. Mary's called the Comedy Oasis. And that was about it. There weren't a lot of these smaller rooms that independent producers are running, like the Wee Johnny's, like the Hanson Brothers, like, you know, Comedy Showcase nights, Winnipeg Comedy Showcase at the Park Theater. So, you know, I was lucky to start then, in as much as there weren't a ton of other people doing it. There was myself and John Youngberg and Jimmy Mack and Bruce Clark and Irwin Barker when they were around. So, you know, it was a great place for me to get a lot of stage time and to, you know, work out figuring out how to be funny, because we all kind of suck when we start, right? But, you know, now I think to be a young guy or gal starting in comedy, you know, I think there's a lot of different places around the city where you can get your stage time and figure out what your style is and what your stage persona is and what your voice is. And it's a great city for that. And it's a great city for comedy fans that love good comedy. You know, Winnipeg has great audiences, and the headliners who come from the States and from other places in Canada say Winnipeg has great audiences. And it's something I think, you know, you can take for granted if you don't travel, but I think it's very true.
All right. I remember Louis C.K. I remember in an interview, he said like one of his most favorite shows he's ever done in Canada was Rumors in Tuxedo, right? Yeah. And just hearing that, it's just from such a global name. I mean, everything aside from Louis C.K., but
pre-2017.
Yeah. But, pre-2017. But just like crazy. It's like little Winnipeg, you know, one of the biggest names in comedy at the time. It's like, yeah, one of my favorite shows that I've ever done.
Yeah, and I was the host or one of the hosts at Rumors back in like 92 or 93 when he was headlining in Winnipeg as a, you know, red-haired, right? He didn't have a clean-shaven young 27-year-old. And I can still remember some of the old jokes probably, but, you know, I remember really loving watching him back then. And, you know, you think everybody you see who's really funny, you think, well, that guy's going to be a star one day. I remember thinking that guy should be a star, right? And then, you know, years later, he's on The Tonight Show. And Rumors would use this clip to set up the show every night as they ran their little, here's who's coming up at the club. Here's famous Louis C.K. on The Tonight Show saying, I have three memories. I remember my dad, you know, doing this when I was a kid. I remember something else. And I remember Rumors Comedy Club in Winnipeg. And they dined out on that clip for the longest time until Louis C.K. made himself a little toxic.
Yeah, before some ish went down with Louis C.K. Now when Louis C.K. comes to town, we have Twitter fights.
Kick sides and decide, are you pro-abuser or anti-abuser?
Yeah.
No middle ground.
Yeah, no middle ground at all, especially online. It's not enough to not have an opinion, so you got to make one. But yeah, I didn't know there was a Yuck Yucks in Winnipeg at one point.
Yeah, they had one in Osborne Village, and that was actually the very first time I did an open mic night was at Yuck Yucks, because they advertised we have open mic on this day of the week. And I was working at the food court in Polo Park, where when it was slow, I found I was the guy just killing the time, making people laugh. And somebody in passing says, you should do the open mic at Yuck Yucks. And I'm like, yeah, I should do the open mic at Yuck Yucks. Right? Because you're 19 and you don't know what you don't know. And that works to your strength when you're young and dumb, right? What's the old, what's the line from, I can't remember his name, wish I didn't know now what I didn't know then, right? Against the wind. Who's that guy? Who's that old artist? Keep running against the wind. Anyway, that's his lyric. Wish I didn't know now what I didn't know then. And it's true, right? You're young and you're dumb and you're like, yeah, I could get up on stage. And you know, looking back, you're like, why would anybody do that? That's a ridiculous thing to do. But you don't know any better, and you do it, and you're glad you did.
Yeah. So when you first did it, was it just kind of like, oh, this is a goof. I'm not sure if I'll ever do this again. Or were you kind of like, oh, I fucking love this?
You get bit by the bug, right? You get bit by the bug, and you know, I started just doing it regularly while I had a day job, or actually during, you know, my second and third year of university. And then after that, realizing I wasn't going to use my degree because I had a degree in architecture and I wasn't good at it. So I had a day job and I was doing it. And then, you know, it snowballs a little bit and you start making a little bit of money doing it. And I remember the first year making like 11 grand at comedy and thinking, well, there you go. I'm good now. I can pay all my 1993 bills, right, on my 11 grand in comedy.
That's funny. Yeah, no, I mean, I felt like that is when I got my first paid gig, the person hosting was like, here's $50. And I was like, yo, Kevin Hart, you better watch your fucking back, man.
It's true.
I'm coming for you. And you better watch yourself. But no, you're right. It's one of those things that it's nice to get paid for your creative endeavors. So I totally feel that when you finally have that cash handed over to you at the end of a show. But I really think, you know, because comedy is such an up and down game. You do really well a couple nights in a row and you're on top of the world. You do poorly a couple nights in a row and you're like, oh, God. It does feel more rewarding just the feeling of making people laugh rather than getting paid. Maybe I'm not getting paid enough to make a statement like that, but what do you think?
No, I know what you mean. I mean, it's certainly like there have been gigs, like if you're, when you get to a stage where you've got like 45 clean minutes and you can do these corporate events, right? You know, we're having a company Christmas party and we want a comic afterwards and there's 500 people and they're all there to eat a big three-course meal at a hotel ballroom and then drink and then we've got entertainment for you tonight and half the people aren't listening and the other half are drunk and it's like, it's painful for 45 minutes and then they give you, you know, a kind of big check at the end of the night and you're like, I would have rather they laughed, right? Like going home with enough money to pay this bill and this bill and this bill in one evening is good, but it doesn't make me feel great about myself getting what feels like overpaid for sucking all night. You'd definitely rather have a good show for nothing than a terrible show for a lot of money. Mm-hmm. The money, I'm not going to say no to the money, but it just kind of makes the shame even worse, right?
Yeah, it does kind of rub a little salt in there. I remember the worst gig I ever did was I was asked to do this trivia night and they're like, oh, you do stand up, right? I'm like, yeah, can I do five? They're like, yeah, sure. And I did five, but the guy at the back didn't know I was going to do five. So he played music over me.
Oh no.
Softly. And I got paid at the end of the night, but oh God, I just wanted to like hurl myself into traffic.
At least that wasn't like due to your own fault though, right? Like that's just producing error.
Well, I mean the clicker wasn't working either. So when I was trying to change the slides on the trivia night, I had to point it 100 and click it 100 times and I could just feel my entire body just like pouring sweat. I'm like, get me off this stage as soon as you can.
I remember it might have even been Louis C.K., but I remember one of the American headliners, you know, back when I was 2 or 3 years into it saying, you know, you'll reach a point where you don't care if they laugh or not. And that's a good thing, right? Where you can go up there and within a minute or two, you know, okay, this isn't going to go well. And that's all right. It's not going to affect how I perform or the speed at which I'm doing this, right? I'm not going to freak out and flop sweat all over the place and race through it in 20 minutes, right? What should be 45 minutes of jokes is going to vanish in 20 minutes because I'm just like freaked out and panicking. And, you know, I'm not saying they're right and you do reach that point and you never care again, but you do get inoculated a little more against that. Mm-hmm. And here my dogs are going to wrestle in the same room. I thought letting them in would let them calm down, but now they're just going to be noisy right on the microphone. But yeah, you do get to a point in your career where you're like, you know, not every show is going to be good. Not every show is going to be your best show and that's all right, you know? And oftentimes it's only, you know, a lot of ways it can only be, it's a bad show because you know what a good show looks like. And the audience is like, hey, that was really fun. We had a good time. And you're like, for me, it was like 5 out of 10, right? I would have rather this and this and this happened. And they're like, that's just, you know, nobody else noticed that. That's just you. You noticed that. But the audience, you know, if you don't betray to the audience that you're uncomfortable, then that's half the battle right there, you know?
Do you remember your worst gig ever?
I probably don't remember my worst gig ever, but I do remember some bad gigs. You know, I think the worst gig ever, you probably just like blank it out of your mind and you just repress the memory. But I do remember, like early on, you know, the three rooms that were in town when I started out, you know, Rumors and Yuck Yucks and Comedy Oasis each agreed to do a noon hour thing at, Old Market Square, right? It's a little lunch hour entertainment for the downtown biz or whatever they called themselves. And so it's just you and a microphone and like five empty city blocks. And you're just kind of like projecting out into nothing. And the odd, you know, person without a home would kind of shuffle by with a bottle of liquor and heckle you drunkenly. And you just feel like, yeah, no, this is a bad career move. I got to go look for a job on Monday. But I remember that being a pretty bad gig. And actually one gentleman came up to the stage, and he was clearly inebriated and having trouble keeping his balance. And the mic was in the stand in front of me, and I just kind of like kept enough distance between me and him that I knew that, you know, if he made some kind of swipe at me, that, you know, my reflexes would keep me safe. And he just kind of took the microphone and put it like basically all the way in his mouth and shouted for Five City Box Chair, "Why don't you fuck off?" And then he shuffled away. And that was the highlight of my set.
That's a pretty wicked joke. I wonder where he came up with that one.
And then to top it, a woman in a similar shape, and I don't know if she knew him, but she came up and she took the mic and then she pointed at the original guy and said, "No, why don't you fuck off?" And then she left. So somebody heckled the heckler.
That
she's got your back, right?
Like, got my back. You know, that's my people.
That seems planned to me. They're like, "Yeah, this is what we're gonna do tonight."
I've never thought about it, but you might be right. Maybe they say, "Okay, here's what we're up to."
Yeah, comedy club. I'll tell them to fuck off.
Theme, by the way, it was middle of noon. It was high noon in the summer of 1992, probably.
That's hilarious. What do you kind of see moving forward with COVID? Do you think that comedy is going to kind of just be like it was this past summer?
I don't know. Like, you know, I'm encouraged by the fact that clubs have reopened. You know, I'm discouraged by the fact that it's probably hard to pay the bills at half capacity or less. I don't think that Zoom and producing stuff online, like sort of this, I'm going to do what would be live stand-up comedy on stage like we know it. I'm going to do it on my laptop to people sitting on their laptop in various places. I don't think that's the way it's going to happen moving forward. I don't know that we know what it's going to look like going forward. It may come back to being what we've always known it as, and I hope it does. I have an email sitting in my box from a comedy person in Toronto who has a pitch. I don't even know what it is, but it's like, "Hey, I wanted to, if you've got time for me, I want to show you the future of comedy." And so I'm intrigued, but I haven't actually heard the pitch. He says, "I need to do a screen share with you." So I think it'll involve some kind of Zoomy kind of element, or, you know, my laptop to your laptop kind of element, but I'm intrigued. I just haven't heard what it is.
The future of comedy.
Part-time is pretty ingenuity, right? So,
I mean, you know, I imagine in 1918, there was a lot of, "Oh my gosh, I don't know that the world will ever be the same again." And a number of years later, they look back and they say, "Oh yeah, you know, that was a pretty awful time, and we lost all these people, and this fell apart and this fell apart, but the world goes on, and, you know, things will come back to a new normal, and comedy will always be something." You know, I remember 9/11, everybody said, "Oh my gosh, it's the death of irony. We can't be ironic anymore. We can't make fun of stuff. We can't be flippant about things. Everything is too important now. Everything means too much now. Everything is too heartfelt now. And we're going to have to figure out how to move forward without irony." And that lasted for just a tiny little while. And if we look back at what we thought was cynical, ironic kind of takes on the world pre-2001, I mean, I think we were extremely optimistic and naive, you know.
Yeah, that lasted for what, 2 days, 2 whole days, where people were like, "It's not cool to make jokes."
And now, you know, we live in a world where it's almost impossible to do satire because you can't tell an onion headline from an actual headline, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, and I do think also with social media, a lot of people are so distant from each other, right? Like, we actually don't know some of the people writing these things. It's easy to assume that somebody's being malicious because of the title when somebody's trying to make a joke, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, and, you know, there's so much to unpack about, you know, humor's role in what's the word I'm looking for? You know, traumatic events. Mm-hmm. You know, when something is awful and horrible, is making a joke about it an appropriate response or a healthy response, or is it the opposite? You know, and I think there's a lot of intelligent things to be said on either side, but I don't think it's necessarily one or the other, right? I think you can use humor you can use it as a crutch. You can use it as a way to not confront things. You can use it in a lot of unhealthy ways. I think there are also a lot of healthy ways to use humor in traumatic moments and in horrible moments and in tragic moments that aren't shame on you for having done that. That was a terrible thing for you to say at this horribly solemn and tragic moment. No, I think humor is an appropriate, healthy response in the right ways.
Yeah. There recently somebody was not very pleased with me. I made a suicide joke, and I'm actually like, I used to be in a psychiatric ward for clinical depression, and I've attempted multiple times. So I told him like, oh, that's my coping mechanism. Like I can laugh at it now cause I'm past it. And that's my way of saying like, yeah, I'm cool and I've dealt with it. And they're like, well, that's not cool. Cause some people might find that offensive. It's like, okay, at that point, if they don't like it, they don't have to listen. Right. Like, I find it very difficult to, you know, tell people that it's not cool to joke about their own situations. If you don't like it, that's fine. You don't have to. Not everybody has to like every bit of humor, but there comes like, when do you cross that line of what's okay to joke about and what's not okay to joke about, where versus what do you like versus what you don't like?
Yeah. And I don't know if I have, you know, I certainly don't have all the answers, and anybody who pretends they do, I'd suggest is almost certainly wrong, or at least not entirely correct. I think a good guideline is simply, are you punching up or are you punching down, right? Mm-hmm. Are you, you know, is your intent to, you know, if you're saying, I have been suicidal, and let me make a joke about being suicidal, you know, the intent is to speak your truth. The intent is to let other people know who have been in that place that they're not alone in that place.
Yeah.
Your intent is to say, it's all right to acknowledge it and to have some perspective on it and to realize that as horrible as you felt in that moment and as horrible as somebody else might feel in that moment, there can be light at the end of the tunnel, right?
Yeah.
If that's your intent, then I think it's a very defensible thing to say that joke about suicide isn't immediately a terrible thing.
Yeah, it's not malicious, right?
Whereas if you're a smug prick who has never once encountered a low moment in your life that you're prepared to acknowledge, and you just want to shit on people who are suicidal, then you're probably an asshole, right? So you can't just lump something under a category and say suicide jokes are out. You have to ask, well, what kind of suicide joke? Why is it a joke? What about it's funny? Where does it come from? What's the intent? And what's the effect on the listener, right? And not every listener is going to respond exactly the same way. And so, you know, if somebody says, I was offended by that because it triggered me, or I was offended by that because somebody I know, you know, I think we get in a lot of trouble when we feel offended on behalf of somebody else without checking with somebody else who you think might be offended by it. Right. If you're speaking for yourself and saying this, you know, I don't even like the, you know, saying the word offended, but you know, this hurt me. And if you are standing there with your microphone with the intent to hurt, then you succeeded. And the guy says, I didn't mean to hurt you, but tell me why it hurt you and let me try to understand. You know, that's a dialogue that's worth having.
Well,
I don't know.
Like, last night I had a talk with like someone close to me, and they lost their father like when they were younger, and she was just talking about it. She's like, yeah, of course I get hurt at first, but like now, like, I can make a joke about like not having a dad. Like, it's just a coping mechanism to me, and it's my own truth, and it just makes me feel comfortable with the situation that I can laugh at it. And a friend of hers who also like didn't have a dad in her life, they like, they joke about it together. So they're like, it's like a share. It's a shared experience, right? And like, if I can joke about this, and then you're getting annoyed or you feel hurt by this, then that's your own problem, right? Like, there's nothing I can do about this. I'm sharing my truth and I'm living my own experience.
Yeah. Yeah. And oh no, I see his eyes moving. I was wondering if we lost him again.
No, I just I heard you start to speak, and I was like, I'll hang back. I'll let him go.
Yeah, no, I mean, I'm a 49-year-old white cisgendered straight male. So there's not a lot for me to punch up at other than the ruling class asshole billionaires who set up a banking system that rewards people for having money and punishing them for not having money, and you know, punches up at a system that treats people of other colors or genders or sexual orientations as second and third and fourth class citizens. I mean, you know, the whole conversation around privilege and how you use it, I think, is very relevant in comedy today. And, you know, I came from an era starting out in the 90s where, you know, I don't think a lot of, you know, comedy is a very white, straight, male kind of field. Mm-hmm. And has been for a long time and is starting to move gradually and sometimes quickly away from that. And certainly as the producer of a comedy festival on CBC television, our mandate every year is to reflect Canada as a community in our casting. So we're not going to have a comedy show of six comics that are all white straight dudes. It's just not going to happen. And mm-hmm. if you're a white straight Duke comic who says, but I'm funnier than this person or that person, you might be, but we're not making a comedy show with six straight white dudes. So
nice. I stand a chance then, is what you're saying.
You stand a chance.
That's all I heard. I heard as soon as you're talking, I just heard you might make it one day. And I was like, fuck yes. Although I hit all the other boxes being a straight cisgendered male. So maybe not, but no, that is a very good point. Jokes aside, that is a very good point, right? Like, you do want to be representative of the community. You do want to kind of, you know, it's hitting that balance, right? You don't want to just give people spots for the sake of giving them spots because of how they look, right? You wouldn't just pull a random guy in and be like, hey, you are what we want to look on stage, so come on in and do stand-up. But at the same time, out of the qualified people, you do want to diversify it a little bit, right? You don't want to go too far in either direction, at least in my opinion. What do you think about that?
No, I mean, I think you've got to offer you know, you got to make space for people, right? And if you have a show or a room, you know, let's talk about the grassroots level, right? If you've got a bar that does comedy, you know, every other Thursday or whatever, and somebody who attends it regularly says, you know what, 9 times out of 10, the people who get on that stage are young white dudes talking about being young white dudes and doing that kind of material, it, not in any kind of deliberate way, sends a message that that's who does comedy. And if you're an Aboriginal gay woman who wanders in off the street to watch a show and sees that, your first inclination isn't to say, hey, I could do that. I feel welcome here. This is my place to shine. I'm going to get on stage. I've got things to say. But if you see that Aboriginal gay woman on stage, and that is you, right? Representation matters. All of a sudden it opens the door and it says, this could be for you. Have you thought about doing that? Could you see yourself doing this? Is this your thing, right? Mm-hmm. And, you know, as North America and Hollywood and, you know, the entertainment juggernaut slowly awakens to this realization that a character doesn't have to be default white, mm-hmm. and that if it's not default white, then the character has to be about its ethnicity, right? You get like script notes, you know, you see people saying, why is this character Asian? We don't even go into their Asianness, right? Well, it's not about their Asianness. That is a person who happens to be Asian who is in that role in this story. And the fact that they are Asian is not a central part of the story, right?
Yeah.
We're asking it to be because you're a white person. And every time you see a non-white person, your instinct is to say, well, explain that to me, make that make sense to me. How, tell me about this because I am an audience and I am the default. Right.
Mm-hmm.
And even, you know, as I think I've got about a half dozen half completed thoughts here, but you know, we see that in comedy right now too, where if we have, for example, you know, Winnipeg Comedy Festival has had a number of comedians on, like say, Noor Hadidi, who is a Muslim female comic, and she's terrific, and she writes a joke as well as anybody writes a joke. So she's up there because the quality of her comedy is at a very high level. But when she's in front of a Winnipeg Gala audience who has paid $35 to come see a show, their expectation, whether they know it or not, is, oh, you're a woman who's Muslim. Tell me about that. Tell me what it's like to be a woman who's Muslim. And if she wants to get on stage and talk about her goldfish or a sports team or anything else that's not about her identity, white audiences are like, well, hang on a second. You haven't told us about you. That's what we want to know about, right? And so the expectation is still, if you're not the default, if you're not a white person or a straight person or a man, that your first duty is to explain your identity in comedic terms for this audience so that they can be welcomed into your world, right? And the expectation isn't there for a white guy, right? The white guy doesn't have to get up and say, oh man, so I'm a white straight male Canadian. Let me tell you what that's like. Whew.
Yeah, I like mayonnaise and I... Yeah, that's
it. He does a joke about that, how, you know, he kind of turns it on its head and says, you know, I'm a straight white guy, you know, and I'll do shows in Toronto and there'll be a black comic and a gay comic and a trans comic and a Muslim comic. And then I get up and I'm like, you know, and they get up and they say like important things about the world and their place in it. And then I get up and I'm like, Weezer's getting worse. I don't know.
That's amazing. That's a really funny joke. Which is also extremely not true. Weezer's still good. but no, I never even thought of that, right? I mean, like, you've had fucking way more comedy experience than I have. So that's something that never even crossed my mind about not having to explain yourself, but some audience members feeling like you should explain yourself if you don't look like what everybody else looks like, but the default in their head, right? And never even crossed my mind.
I mean, you know, and it's not hard to picture. So if I flew to China and an audience of 500 English-speaking Chinese filled a theater to see me, my instinct is, okay, I better explain what it means to be white and Canadian to them, right? Mm-hmm. Because I'm not just going to jump into their world and say, here's a local reference and here's something you can relate to and here's something, right? Mm-hmm. So it's always that outsider perspective. Let me tell you about my world and how I fit as a small piece of the larger world, right? And that's, you know, in one respect understandable, but that seems to me to be an early stage of acceptance of everyone on stage, right? Gradually, you want to get to a place where if you're going to do a 10-minute set, the 10-minute set shouldn't be, let me explain myself to you, right? Courtney Gilmore is a comic in Toronto who was born without either arm and one leg, right? And so naturally, when audiences see her, their expectation is, okay, let's hear the jokes about your missing limbs, right? Mm-hmm. And so you've got to get through that gate before they're interested in hearing about your take on Uber or your take on dating or your take on anything else. Sorry, my dogs are making noise again.
No, it's all good. It's all good. Well, I was going to say, like, her take on Uber is probably that it's necessary for her, right?
Yeah, I mean, yeah. So her take on Uber, again, is going to reference the Uber driver's response to her and how she pays them and how, you know, easy or difficult it is to get change back. And right.
Yeah, exactly. Right. I mean, like,
I think she does a joke about getting in a cab or an Uber and the guy's like, first thing he said was, oh my gosh, are you okay? Like, this happened to me recently.
That's funny. I think that's when I first started, that was one of the first things that people told me, kind of, you know. But I was told that it's because you know it really well and therefore it might be easier to write jokes about. So I really appreciate you giving me the other kind of standpoint where I didn't even think of it like that. You know, I kind of just heard it one way. But then again, the person who told me that was also not a white person. So,
yeah, I mean, I 100% believe, you know, write what you know and speak your truth and say what's close to your heart and find your voice, right? You know. And for better, for worse, the audiences that you're in front are ones that you'll have very little control over, right? Whether they're, you know, if you're here in Winnipeg and they're 95% straight and white, that's who you have to figure out how to make them laugh, right? You know, you go to Toronto and they'll have shows at Comedy Bar that are LGBTQ shows and attract, I have to assume, having been to some of them, you know, when they say any straight people here and, you know, for the sake of the show, I don't stay silent. I'll go, woo, right? I'll be the one straight guy in the crowd. And,
yeah.
And then I have to be the butt of the joke for, you know, it's straighty over here, right?
For you.
So it's, you know, you have to know your audience. You have to know what their references are to a certain extent. And if you have references that aren't theirs, you have to explain them to them in a way that now they're in your world and now they can understand and now they're going to get the joke. Yeah, it's all the work of being a comedian.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. You know, there's so many factors that go into it. What the crowd knows, what you know, trying not too hard to just do what the crowd wants, but also at the same time, not too hard to just do what you find funny and nobody else finds it funny. And you're just up there speaking for 45 minutes now and it's painful and you're like, oh my God, when am I going to get a giggle? But maybe you've hit that threshold that you talked about earlier and you just don't care. You like talking to people regardless of whether they laugh or not.
Yeah. And I mean, you know, part of it is, you know, part of it's comedy, common ground, and part of it's just, you know, the quality of your craft, right? And if you're writing good jokes and, you know, they're good jokes, whether the references are easily understood or understood from context or don't matter if you understand them from context, right? There's performance, there's joke construction, there's timing, there's a million other things that go into whether an audience responds to you or not, right?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, either way, I think comedy is such a versatile art and, you know, you get so many people and from so many different walks of life and so many different experiences that it's kind of something that'll never run out, right?
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, you look at all the best people at it or the most successful people at it, and they are not trying to please everybody in most respects, right? Like Bill Burr doesn't go out of his way to please everybody, and Ellen doesn't necessarily go out of her way to please anybody, everybody, as, you know, as universally beloved her, you know, her material and her character is. Maybe she's a poor example of saying universally beloved after all the horror stories about her coming out, but...
Yeah, we're hitting all the bases on the people who used to be loved but aren't anymore, right? Louis C.K., Allen.
Bill Cosby.
Yeah, I was just going to say Cosby's coming up.
I got into it. Like, if you ask me, like, well, you know, what are your early comedy influences? I'm like, well, I guess when I was a kid, I had, like, what, 6, 8, 10 LPs of Bill Cosby that I'd listened to over and over again. And
yeah. Did you ever listen to that podcast, Chasing Cosby? It was, like, a 6-part.
Tell me about it.
Series on the car. It was fantastic, but it got a little too graphic for me. I tapped out on episode 4. I couldn't stick through it, but it's fascinating in terms of how beloved Bill Cosby was and how, you know, I'm 21 years old. I do not remember Bill Cosby at all in his anywhere close to his peak, right? So for me, it's less weird, but for people who grew up with Bill Cosby and how he was seen as like America's father from a comedy standpoint for a long time. And now knowing what he was doing now is like, what the fuck was going on?
Yep. It's pretty crazy. Like, it's really crazy. And you think, you know, and it's not even, I don't know. It was kind of, I'm trying to remember the timeline of it all coming unraveled. Cause I mean, the allegations have been around for a long time. Right. And it was, I guess, the Hannibal Buress, thing that got shared around on social media that revived it enough that authorities could no longer ignore it. But yeah, it is crazy. I remember being like maybe 8 or 10, like it was pre the Cosby Show. So the Cosby Show probably started in 83, 84, or something like that, maybe 85. I could go on Google and find out in 2 seconds. But I remember being like a young kid and Cosby was coming to town. He was going to do the Centennial Concert Hall. So like what, 2,000 seats, right? Maybe something like that. And so I said, for my birthday, I don't want a gift. Let's go see Bill Cosby. And we did. We went and saw Bill Cosby. And it was like, I was so happy. And the Cosby Show was a sitcom that I watched as a teenager. And, you know, and then you look back and you're like, oh my gosh, there was that Cosby Show episode where he's like, he's got a barbecue sauce that's like an aphrodisiac. It was basically like his confessional, right? Oh, you put this in the thing and then the ladies, they get, right? It's creepy to watch now.
Yeah. I bet it doesn't hit quite the same 30, 40 years later, right?
And the whole button on the episode was one of the daughters, right? Like Rudy. Was it Rudy? Was it that young? Was it like the six-year-old daughter is about to eat some of it, right? And she's got her little six-year-old buddy next to her, right? Their little boyfriend. And Cosby, like, sees her going to bite the chicken with the special sauce on it. And he, like, swats it out of her hand. No, you don't. Right? It's so strange.
Yeah, that's really weird. Yeah, and even, like, the pod, I'm not going to go into detail because that's disgusting. I don't think you want to hear that. But, like, the podcast was talking about it a lot. It's, like, how he would, like, lure people in and, like, use his fame and his persona and his power. And it's, fuck, man. Even with, like, Harvey Weinstein, when I remember that those allegations came out, I was like, who the hell is Harvey Weinstein? That sounds like a nobody. Then I looked into his name. I was like, oh, shit, this dude made everything.
He made everything. You couldn't get something made if you didn't.
Yeah, literally. When you start looking at the fine print in movies, it's like, oh, Weinstein, 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 Weinstein. And then.
What was John Mulaney's joke at, he did like an Independent Spirit Awards monologue, you know, the year after that story hit the fan, and he was, you know, taken down and lost all his, you know, lost his career and was facing criminal charges and everything else. And Mulaney says something like, there's a famous quote from Harvey Weinstein saying, no one's going to remember my Oscars. All they're going to say on my headstone is America's Next Top Model. I think that was it, or Project Runway, one of those shows, right? He did one of those reality shows. And Mulaney's like, don't worry, Harvey. It's not going to say that anymore. It's going to say XXL unmarked grave.
That's good. Yeah, but again, like, even not even the movies that he worked on, but just his reach too, like how many people were in his corner, how many people he knew that were in high positions is insane, right? And I don't want to go too far into the rise and fall of powerful people in the media, because then we're going to get on the subject of OJ and we'll go really off the rails, but you kind of see where I'm going, right?
Maybe. Where are you going? I'm not sure.
Just in how crazy it is sometimes with people who have public, you know, they have positive images in the media, positive images, positive personas. Oh, movie director,
yeah,
you know, filmmaker, comedian.
Yeah.
Yeah, sometimes a quick fall from grace comes really harshly.
And I don't, you know, I'm one of those people who, you know, my brain, for whatever reason, and maybe I'm entirely backwards in this thinking, but my brain, it likes to sort some of the people into, oh, you know, there's good people who make mistakes and none of us are perfect. And if you think about the worst thing you've ever done and having to apologize to everyone in the world about that, right, how would you look? So there's, you know, there's all of us being human and making mistakes and having weaknesses and screwing up and being selfish pricks and assholes and needing forgiveness and a second chance. And then there's just like horrible pieces of shit, right, who are just unredeemably awful and will ruin people without conscience, right? Mm-hmm. And I don't know if that's a reasonable thing to do or not, or if I'm just sorting people unnecessarily into piles, but yeah.
I mean, I teeter back and forth between the idea of there's no such thing as a good or evil person and that kind of logic that you have. So I can definitely see your heads at and kind of going back and forth.
Like, as much as the U.S. president is a deeply damaged person, it's increasingly hard to have sympathy for him, or to say, man, that poor guy, how he must have been hurt as a child by his neglectful parents to have turned out so awful. But mm-hmm. You know, the amount of suffering that he causes to so many people, it's just very hard to say, well, you know, where did that come from? What happened to him? That must have been so awful for him.
Yeah. I think with Trump specifically, I think he has such an extremely overinflated sense of ego and narcissism that leads him into all the other areas of bigotry that we've seen him kind of dip his feet into or jump headfirst into, you know. I think that's kind of where it all stems from.
Yeah.
I don't think that's too far off. But yeah, I agree with you. I think it's good that you try to show empathy to some people who do bad things or who display bigoted behavior, because I think that's part of the human experience, you know. What's that person going through? How are they dealing with life? What kind of bad things happened to them? What led them to get on this path? At the same point, after a certain point, there needs to be a cutoff point for justice, right? Like if you kill five people, yeah, you need to go to jail.
Or at least comedy jail. Sure. If we want to get back to comedy, absolutely. I don't know. There's consequences in the world, you know? At the end of the day, you want everyone to be redeemed and you want everyone to be redeemable. And certainly you want to be forgiven for your own mistakes and to make good on them, right? And sometimes you can fix stuff and sometimes you can't, but you can let it go and move on. But yeah, who knows? Who knows? This is going to be the subject of my new album.
I can't wait for it to come out.
I don't even have an old album, so I don't know what I'm talking
about. Debut album.
My debut album.
Who knows?
For what a 49-year-old white guy from Winnipeg has to say about the world.
Hey, if you release it, I'll tune in.
That's good. That's good. I'm encouraged by, I look at some of the comedy albums that people put out and, you know, get lots of recognition. And, you know, Ivan Decker winning a Juno and Dave Merhage and Sophie Butler winning a Juno. I'm thinking, well, God damn it. Good for them, you know? Mm-hmm. And it's not that far of a journey to say, you know, what do you have to say about the world? And let's do it in a funny way. And let's do it on stage in front of a crowd. And let's have some microphones and let's put it out to the world. And yeah.
Yeah. And there are a lot of talented Winnipeg comics. There are a lot of talented Canadian comics. I think comedy in Canada is in good hands. What do you think?
Yeah. I mean, it's a shame that we, you know, smarter people than I have said better things about this, but you know, it's a shame that we don't have a star system in Canada. We don't recognize people until they go to the States and make it there and then call them stars and say they're ours, you know, where they're Canadian. Did you know Celine Dion's Canadian? Did you know Martin Short's Canadian? You know, but if either of those had like stayed in Canada, somehow Quebec manages to have a star system and there are people who work exclusively in the province of Quebec on television and in film and, you know, touring live if you're a comic. And they're like goddamn celebrities, you know, and don't really have that in Canada. We're kind of too self-conscious and I don't know what the word is, but yeah, you know, every year at Winnipeg Comedy Festival, we're like, all right, who's going to host our gala? Who's sufficiently famous and well-known and somewhat affordable? Because, you know, I would love to have Catherine O'Hara hosting a gala in 2 weeks. And God bless her, Winnipeg Comedy Festival is not really on Catherine O'Hara's radar, right? And so you phone Catherine O'Hara's agent and you said, would Catherine be interested? And, you know, we can pay her this much. Or if you say we need to pay her more, we can try to find more. And they're like, you know what? We thank you for your interest. And, yeah, you know, it's just not... It's not doable.
Yeah, we wish you well, but it's not. We wish you well.
And you go to Montreal, and Montreal, God bless them, can get every top comic in North America. But guess what? They're all the big stars are the American stars, right? And if you're lucky enough, a Canadian comic will have a, you know, on each gala there'll be a spot or two out of the six or seven comics that are filled with Canadians, and. You'll read the reviews in the paper the next day in the Montreal Gazette. And often the Gazette will talk about how great, you know, Eliza Schlesinger was and how great Bill Burr was. And the Canadians who did just as well with a live audience will not get a mention. And you're like, what's the point of putting a Canadian on the gala to shine next to the megastars that we consider stars and who are... you know, punching at the same weight in the same weight class and then can get like zero rub and zero recognition for it, you know?
Tough crowd.
It's very strange.
Yeah. Some crowds are tougher than others, right? Whether they're writing or whether they're in the stands.
Yeah, exactly. But when they, you know, when they kill, you know, you see Graham Clark do a Just for Laughs gala and the audience is like, oh my God, that guy's so funny. And he is. And, then Graham Clark gets back on a plane home and has a nice memory.
Yeah, I see your point. I mean, then one of us is just going to have to I mean, a comic in general, Canadian, one of us, maybe you or me, if you really want to try, just got to become famous then. There we go.
Let's just try to be famous. Has anybody done that yet?
Let's just start on TikTok. That's all you got to do.
I saw a great tweet. I think it was today. It was like, so if I download TikTok, which button do I push to become famous?
I think you got to put For You page in the hashtag with all other 49,000 billion hashtags on that app and you'll make it. Is there something, there's a ridiculous, I think it really is like 4,900 billion hashtags with For You page on there. Like that's insane.
That's crazy.
That is a nuts volume. But yeah, no, you know what? I'll work on being famous and I'll check in with you on how it's going.
Yeah, I'll be on your show when I'm famous if you want to have me.
Oh, yeah, totally. Yeah, we'll throw it back. We'll be like, you know, remember back in 2020 when people were worried about comedy dying and here I am, famous.
You were so naive back then. Remember during COVID days, you were terrified the comedy would die? Oh, man, that was funny.
Yeah, how silly were we to believe that? Yeah, and we'll laugh and clink a glass of wine or sparkling juice if you're about that action or whatever you drink. I don't know. I just kind of assume your drink of choice, but we'll throw our heads back and laugh at whatever, doing shows at Yuck Yucks in Winnipeg when it was still here or whatever. Yeah, but no, I think Canadian comedy is very good. And even if there aren't any stars and even if it doesn't change in our lifetimes, I'm cool with supporting it.
For sure. Yeah, I mean, you know, what other choice do we have? Are we going to say until people are famous, we're not interested, right?
Yeah, that's we'll see how that works out. The
work is the work. And, you know, I remember reading a Ron James interview years ago, right? And, you know, Ron went to LA and tried his hand at that whole scene and, you know, had a part in an Ernest Goes to Wherever Ernest Went movie. And, you know, came back to Canada and got a TV show of his own in Canada and tours the country selling out theaters. And, you know, as far as recent Canadian stand-ups go, you can't get much bigger in Canada than Ron James, right? And his quote was, you know, wherever you are, whether it's in LA and whether it's in front of 1,000 people or 100 people at the Legion, you know, the function of the work is to make people laugh. And if you're doing that night in and night out and there's food on your table, then you're a lucky person and you're blessed and you've got basically everything you asked for by getting into the business, which is doing the work and feeding yourself and your family, right?
Yeah, there was a, I'll end with this because we're just past an hour. Jerry Seinfeld, there's a quote I saw of his that I really liked. And he said, you know, for the longest time in my career, I never worried about agents or popularity contests or money. The only thing I asked myself was, am I getting funnier?
Yeah. And, you know, that's, I think, the best thing you can do, in my opinion, if you're a young comic or any comic, whether you're starting out or a few years in, is do it because you love it and do it because you enjoy it and do it because you can. And if you can pay the bills doing it, God bless you. And if you can't pay the bills with it and you're paying the bills doing something else in the hours you're not doing comedy, there's no shame in that. And, you know, I've never made a career off performing stand-up in the 30 years I've been doing stand-up. There's always been other things that have been propping it up. And one of the legs on my financial stool is stand-up. And if I didn't do any stand-up, that would take a big chunk out of what I make every year. But if I don't do any stand-up, I can still pay some bills, right? But if everything else dried up and I was only doing stand-up, I would have to hustle just like 300% more, right? Mm-hmm. So anybody who's out there just paying the bills, doing stand-up, like, to me, that's remarkable. And
yeah,
also part of me is going, but why put yourself in that position? That seems terrifying.
Different strokes for different folks, I guess.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, this is, we're heading out to the end. Dean, is there anything you'd like to let people know before we go or no?
We're going to do some more shows at the Gas Station Arts Center. If nothing changes in the Code Orange, we're going to do some shows in a couple of weeks, October 22, 23, 24. Come on down. You'll be able to check the website, winnipegcomedyfestival.com, shortly. We're going to get that updated with what we're doing. And then on the Sunday, I'm very excited. Did you follow Pat Thornton's Larry Looks on Twitter or Instagram or Facebook?
I didn't.
So Pat Thornton's a stand-up in Toronto, mm-hmm. and his wife is a school teacher, I think sort of that early years, kindergarten, grade one, something around there. I hope I'm not wrong. Mm-hmm. And in March, the middle of March, they decided, all right, there's nothing happening for us right now. And we've got a newborn baby named Larry. And every day, just to keep ourselves entertained and have something to do to keep busy during this crazy lockdown that we don't know how it's going to end or when, is we're going to find things around the house in our craft bin and costume bin and clothes bin. And we're going to dress our baby up every day in a new, like as a new celebrity. So the first one was Roberta Bondar, right? And then they did this 100 days in a row. Every day, new costume, and they'd post the pictures on social media, Twitter and Instagram and Facebook, called it Larry Looks. There you go. There's Hulk Hogan, yep. Baby Larry Looks. And just they got some press, you know, nationally from some of the national papers and from CTV and CBC TV. And so I tell you all that to set up that Sunday, October 25th, if I had my way, Pat would be flying to Winnipeg to do this show live, but because we can't fly somebody in from Toronto for non-film television purposes, we're going to get Pat and Maggie, his wife, to do a Larry Looks live Zoom show.
Oh, wow.
For a theater crowd at the Gas Station Arts Center, and hopefully a Zoom audience as well, if you want to tune in on Zoom. So look at the Winnipeg Comedy Festival website a week from now. That'll for sure be up. And Pat and his wife are going to tell the story of Larry Looks and share the pictures and tell the stories behind them and make you laugh and make you cry. And just so many people in the comments underneath each day's picture saying, like, you have no idea how much this cheers me up every day to see this. And you guys are doing amazing stuff. And just keep doing it. Because it was such a nice little feel-good story during COVID. And Pat is a sweetheart and one of the funniest people you'll know. And his wife, who I haven't met, seems to be equally a sweetheart, maybe even more so. And so I'm looking forward to that very, very much.
Yeah, you are. Yeah, you're doing great things, man. I can't believe that you're still finding ways to fit comedy shows in here. They're few and far between, but I appreciate you doing that. And I'll do my best to come out and support, and hopefully we get to be disappointed from this episode.
That's very kind.
Dean, this is a lot of fun. I really enjoyed this.
No, thanks for inviting me. I didn't know what to expect. I had a wonderful time.
Awesome. I'm glad to hear that then. This is us signing off on Winnipeg's Finest. Have a wonderful week.
Peace.